This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We're already experiencing some of the intense heat and extended dry spells we usually associate with late July and early August, broken up by heavy downpours that can temporarily swamp container gardens and flower beds. Gardening in our climate can be a challenge, and the trick is choosing the proper plants and knowing what they need to stay healthy and to grow. Joining us to answer your gardening and landscape questions are Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David and Peter, good to see you this afternoon.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
David, today's kind of a prime example. It's been rainy and wet, and it's going to make for some soggy gardens and lawns. And then you know what? We'll get that dry spell. That'll come along. So when it comes to gardening around here, how do you deal with the variable weather that we get?
Well, it's just typical of what we're and it seems like, you know, I talk to people and they just keep saying, you know, the new normal is abnormal. And that's where we seem to be. But yeah, it's really interesting. Even when we have a perfect growing season and we have the right amount of rainfall that's gone through at the end of the year, we measure that rainfall and it's been just what we should be getting. There are periods in that year where we went without rainfall for 2 weeks and then we got deluged with maybe 3 inches on a Saturday. And, you know, it doesn't fall perfectly. So even when you have a really good year, you are going to, you know, if you can supplement watering and do those things, you're really way ahead.
But we're still below average for rainfall so far this season, right? And mm-hmm. and heavy downpours they're not as helpful as, say, a nice, light, steady rain, right?
And, you know, preferably it'd come on about 9 o'clock and at night and end first thing in the morning. But it's just, you know, the we have to take it at this time of year whenever we can get that rainfall, because it's so critical to us now. And honestly, you know, I've heard farmers talk about, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that was a $500,000 rainfall for me. You know, it can be that beneficial to them. So it's very important to us to get the right amount of rainfall, and of course to be able to conserve that through you know good soil practices, good production practices. Those are all things that we need to, you know, water is really something that I think is going to become an issue more and more throughout the country as we get into
like what California has been experiencing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How valuable is a rain gauge? You got me started on that, and I've been using one, and you know what, it's really helped change my perspective on how I garden and how I take care of my plants.
I think it's the greatest social instrument you can have, because there's nothing better than going out in the back and over your back fence discussing how much rain you got with your neighbor. But it is fun, because, you know, the one thing that I always talk to Peter about is that how spotty our thunderstorms are in the summer. And, you know, I don't know how many times I have been gardening in my backyard or my plot in Morning View, Kentucky, and I'll be listening to the Reds on radio, and the Reds have got a rain delay significant. The game will be canceled, and I'm in full sun and just in perfect shape out in Morning View, which is, you know, 20 miles or so away. So they are spotty.
My wife came home after the heavy rains we had this weekend. She looked at our rain gauge and she said, "Look at that, 3.5 inches. I don't have to water the plants tonight."
That's right. That is a good feeling too. It really is. If you've been watering, I think, you know, standing there with a watering wand is one of the most unproductive. I mean, it's critical that you do it, but boy, you're sitting there thinking of a million other things that you need to be doing.
It's like watching grass grow.
Peter, well, the gauges really help you monitor the amount of water, so it actually helps you conserve a great deal of water, because you know when not to water. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you also know when too. But so I think that it kind of provides a kind of a logic to it. And also, if you have children or you work with youth and education programs, it's a really great tool, and it's an opportunity to discuss water conservation and appropriate use of water for irrigation.
So, Peter, how do you think? How can people deal with this variable climate that we have around here? We've heard David's take on this, but what do you think?
Well, it's pretty rough. I mean, some things to think about when you start getting a lot of rain is to let your soil drain and get dry before you go into the garden. If you're walking on your paths, it's not a big deal, but you don't want to go into the beds, and because when the soil is wet, it'll really compact the soil. After the soil dries out, and it may be still a little too damp to work into, But that also could be an excellent opportunity for pulling weeds, because you can get these weeds with deeper tap roots out, will pull out and it'll come out a lot easier. So you can have a kind of a strategy to work there.
So what do you think of rain barrels and other ways that homeowners can make better use of the rain that we get?
Well, it's good. A 55-gallon rain barrel, I think it's a 1,000-square-foot roof, will fill up a 55-gallon rain barrel in a 1-inch rain probably 10, 20 times. So, you can collect water fairly easily. So even if you have a small garden shed, to put a rain barrel next to it is really effective. Now, the nice thing about rainwater is there's no chlorine in it. Mm-hmm. So that's a thing. Now, another trick if you can do also is if you have an open barrel in your garden, you can fill it with your hose and let it stand and evaporate. And you can just put a piece of cloth on top of it or a lid, and that'll take care of not getting the mosquitoes in it.
You know, we have had for centuries, all of our rural clientele have cisterns on their homes. And a lot of times I had a cistern when we had to build our home in Morningview, and that was 30 some odd years ago. And since then, we've gotten city water. They've run a water line down our street. We've been able to tie into it. So I still have this cistern, gigantic cistern under my back porch that I still collect rain in. And that's the water that I use in my garden. And I just pump it from the cistern. And I don't know why we haven't looked at those kind of things for watering lawns or for watering. It's free. It's coming off your roof. I don't know whether there's safety issues. I know that the water companies do not want any of that water getting into our chlorinated water and those kind of things. But I almost think that there should be a way that we could work with that, and it would really drastically enable us to water when we go through severe droughts and use that water.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there's a lot of common sense applications for this.
Well, when they talk about with new building construction, they talk about collecting water off roofs and stuff, and we start having the pipes running through the building, they worry about cross-contamination later on. But if you have an older home with a cistern that's completely independent, and the pipe that you're coming out of probably doesn't even is outside the house, so there's no possibility of cross contamination. It's a good way to go. But you can get, the 55-gallon standard plastic barrels are good. If you get a barrel that's opaque, it's better, because then you won't grow algae in it. And then you can, there are other containers you can get. They're anywhere from 175-gallon on up that you can do. And I know in some areas like Arizona and Texas, I think it's part of building code in some communities that you have rainwater catchment.
They're really starting to make them very attractive as well, planters in them and things like that. So it's a great way to supplement your water.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Or you can email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And David, I get home on a hot, sunny day, and the plants in the containers look wilted. Should I water every day or just a heavy soak every day? What's the best way to handle that?
It, in a container, if we get into July and August and we've got those really hot summer days, you can almost water some of those container plants twice a day to keep them from wilting. So I would do it very early in the morning. And there's no reason why in a container plant that you can't put mulch up on the top of the pot and conserve some of the water that way, keep the water in the root zone. But, containers are gorgeous because they put the color and everything right at eye level. They're focal points in your landscape, but they're going to require more water. So, when they're wilted, they need water.
Mulch I like in container. I usually do vegetables in them around our front porch, a couple things every year. But pine fines or something, soil conditioner they call it, is a really good mulch. You put an inch or two of that on top of it, and it holds in the moisture. But then also after you remove the plant at the end of the season, you can turn that into the soil, and so it's also a soil builder. And it's something you have to buy, but it's real effective. You don't want to use coarse wood chips, and I would not use like cedar chips or any of the hardwood mulches on top of a small garden.
And Peter, does the
small container?
Does the type of soil make a difference? You've got topsoil, potting, soil peat, so. What's the best thing for a container?
Well, containers, sometimes people put in things like some perlite or vermiculite and or you know, peat. I don't like to use peat because it's not very sustainable, but you know, you want soil with a good humus level, you know, something that'll absorb water. And so it's good. And often with containers, people want a lighter soil mix if you're going to move the container.
You can lighten those mixes of compost, obviously. You can lighten up with the perlite or vermiculite. Those are excellent. And that soil, when you're done with that plant for the year, make sure you compost it, add it to your pile, because it still has a lot of benefits in it and nutrients. And I couldn't live anymore without pine bark chips, because that's just a great soil conditioner. And we have really gone to using them exclusively in our gardens at the office, just because the plants just thrive under them.
And kind of along the same lines as a container, the raised gardens, mm-hmm. they have to have a lot more water than what
right,
you expect, don't they?
Right, they do. You know, the benefit of those is when it's a wet season, they drain rapidly. But during a dry season, you do have to supplement more often, because you've just improved the drainage in those raised beds. So you've got to be prepared to do that.
And to a certain degree, the wood can act as a kind of wick in a way, too. So you'll notice that the beds will dry out on the edges before they dry out, obviously, in the middle.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Peter, are there certain plants and flowers that do better in this type of back and forth weather?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like if you get in with your tomatoes and your peppers, you can, particularly tomatoes, you can start having some problems with some fungus and things like that. So you want to, a lot of times what I'll do with my tomato plants is I'll remove some of the lower leaves and make sure that there's good spacing so we get airflow through them. But in terms of, I mean, watercress, I don't know. I can't think of a vegetable plant that thrives in heavy water.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they like well-drained soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We will continue our conversation with our horticulture experts, and you can join us with your questions at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Here to answer your gardening and landscape questions are Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, we were talking about containers a few minutes ago. Is it a common mistake in planting in containers, not using the appropriate size container to start? And how do you judge? What's the right size to use for different plants?
That's really an issue for, I think, any kind of, we grow a lot of citrus plants, and we have gardenias in pots outside on our patio. And I don't, you know, one of my least favorite jobs, I guess, is repotting these things. So I always tend to go with a much bigger pot than I should. And that is a mistake, because all that extra soil in there is holding moisture, and you'll get run into some root rotting. And they really recommend that you go, if it's a perennial plant or one that you're going to keep in your home or bring it in home at the end of the summer, that you just go with the next size larger or two sizes larger and stick with that, rather than, you know, I want to get it all done at one time, and I get way too ambitious and put them in too big a container. But then for vegetables, I think you really, you know, we always say 5-gallon bucket minimum for a tomato, and you do want good size on vegetables, I think.
Yeah, and if you look at the back of any seed pack, it gives recommended spacing. But, you know, like even in a raised, say you have a 4 by 10 foot raised bed in your garden at home, you know, you want to give at least, you know, an area 2 feet by 2 feet or 4 square feet to one tomato plant.
You know, I keep hearing people have trouble growing carrots, and certainly we do with our soils here. But do yourself a favor and grow some carrots in a container, putting in that compost perlite mixture early in the season. It's getting awful late to be doing it now. Carrots like cool temperatures. But, you know, you'll get carrots, and you can put them pretty densely. The foliage on carrots is gorgeous to begin with. It's that fern-like. And there is nothing sweeter than a carrot pulled right from a container or from a garden. It's much different than what you're going to buy at the store. Kids love those.
Yeah, and if you grow some of the varieties that are smaller, carrots as opposed to trying to do a big, giant juice carrots better. But, you know, I really think doing a, you know, an early August planting some and, you know, protecting the seeds early on with a little bit of row cover and then for a fall harvest is really the best carrots that you can get. I always say that after a lot of things, a lot of greens and stuff, after they're nipped by the frost a little bit, they're a lot sweeter and they really pump up the sugar in these plants.
Here's a challenge for you. My wife and I inherited a cactus from her dad. It must be about 50 years old. And we felt like it was in too small of a pot, so we transplanted it. And, you know, the pot is probably about twice as big as the cactus. So I guess we'll just have to see how it does over the years.
It's, you know, it's amazing. Everybody's got plant stories, but we moved a tremendous amount of times growing up, and we started in Cincinnati, moved to Chicago, moved to Michigan, moved to Louisville, and every move we moved a cactus with us, and that same cactus is still alive today. It's just, you know, it's amazing.
Do cactuses have a long lifespan? I guess they must.
They do.
I think they're kind of like tortoises or something. They just go forever.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Eric in Forest Park. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon. I have a vegetable garden that's a raised bed, and years ago it was lined with old railroad ties, and those are breaking down. Of course, railroad ties are not something you should do with a vegetable garden anyway. But I was wondering, is there some kind of recyclable material that I can use to rebuild the borders of that garden? I understand from a master gardener friend that using concrete pavers, like the retaining wall pavers, is not a good idea for gardens either.
Yeah, well, the concrete is a problem because it'll absorb the moisture out. And some concrete also, they say, has fly ash in it, so there's some concerns about that. Plus, if you're working around your garden, that's a very hard surface to lean up against. So in terms of recycled sort of green materials, you have like those products like Trex, the composite lumbers. You can use those. The drawback on those is that they're sort of lower width or smaller widths. I think the standard is like 6 inches or something, so you got to do a couple tiers. But also the material flexes. Mm-hmm. And so you have to sink into the soil some sort of retaining stakes. But if you properly brace them, I mean, it's an effective thing. I mean, they kind of still the most popular kind of gold standard is to use cedar.
Right. Yeah. The composite materials that made out of there, I guess they're made out of plastic and blended with wood material. They'll be here centuries from now. It's really durable. It doesn't break down. They use them a lot for boat docks, and of course now they're using them decks. It's not cheap.
Let's talk with Jess in Pleasant Ridge. Hi, Jess.
Hello. I kind of have a two-parter question. I have some heirloom tomatoes growing in 5-gallon buckets. And with the rain we've been getting, I know you hit on earlier, the top part of the soil always is kind of damp. I have about 20 blossoms on each plant right now that have opened, but not really any tomatoes yet. I need to know, do I still need the water so I can get way down there where the roots are? And then also, because I have a lot of foliage and a lot of greens, but they say sometimes too much water, you get a lot of greens, but maybe not a lot of tomatoes.
You know, if you're fertilizing a lot, that certainly is a problem. So I would probably back off on the fertilizer. We usually recommend that let the first tomatoes set on there, get about the size of a dime, and then you can start. Then you can fertilize again. I think you're going to get tomatoes. You've got tomatoes will, you know, they don't really need insects, although that's beneficial. But they're going to pollinate, and you will get fruit to set. A lot of problems that we have with container-grown tomatoes is a disease, or it's a physiological disorder called blossom end rot, and that's an uneven supply of moisture in that pot. So I would water heavily and let them dry out thoroughly and then water again. And really, I don't know, Peter, even a little bit of wilting is not that bad to know right when to rewater.
And Jess, did you say that do the buckets have bottom holes for draining?
Yeah, I was saying, so you make sure you have bottom holes. And if it's a really rainy period, like we've been having a couple short spurts of it over a couple of days, sometimes I'll even take a pot like that and set it up on a couple spacers, like whether it be bricks or slats of wood. If you start noticing in your pot, like there's standing water on the top, and that'll allow the pot to drain more quickly. Then as soon as the rain, heavy rains are over, and your pot gets the moisture you want, remove those spacers and let them sit flat on the ground.
I have them on bricks. They're sitting on bricks, and then there's,
okay.
I drilled 5 holes in the bottom and then 4 holes about an inch up on the side.
Oh, you should be fine.
Yeah. Because when the rain comes, I can see that it's saturated, but sometimes I'll put a stick down in there, and near the bottom, that soil sometimes is not as wet, and I didn't know if I need to still water them on days when it rains to make sure that the roots are getting enough water.
When you're putting on water, put it on to the point that it drains out the bottom. You can actually see the water go through the pot and come out on the bricks, so that's how deeply you should be watering, and then back off.
Okay.
And like Dave alluded to, too, is it's not necessarily bad for the soil to ever, you don't want it to go brick dry, but, you know, one of the things is that the plant wants to, you know, if it's overfed and it's got a lot of moisture, it grows leaves instead of fruit because there's not the stress on it to want to procreate. It feels like everything's fine. I don't need to, you know, grow fruit so that I can, you know, reproduce and, you know, continue my species.
Jess, thanks for the phone call. We had a call from Carl in Pleasant Ridge, and he wondered if you could talk about drip irrigation.
Sure. If there's a lot of different ways, it's, you know, I think it's one of those things where people think about it and they go, oh, that's way too complicated. But it's really a pretty simple system. There's so many of them now that you can buy just locally at hardware stores, or you can certainly make your own. But we have soaker hoses, and we have things that can be adapted to your hose. And the drip is just critical because it puts the moisture right at the base of the plant. It doesn't get the foliage wet. It just drips into that root zone, and it's just the ultimate way to go to lessen your amount of water. It lessens the amount of weeds as well because you're just watering the plant that you want. And you can even, there are some systems where you can inject or have fertilizer run through the drip line, and it's a water soluble product, and it'll put the fertilizer solution right at the plant base.
Yeah, and there's different products too. There's like rigid, like a plastic pipe systems that you can use. They're cumbersome and more expensive, but there's also what they call drip tape now. It's a lot lighter weight, it's less expensive, and because the one thing you have to do is you can't have any of that stay out over winter, because there's water in it, it freezes and expands and contracts, and it'll break your pipes and your piping. So you got to make sure you either blow it out with an air compressor and make sure that it's empty. But it's really best then just to bring the material in, so these tape systems are better. But if, you know, depending on the size of your garden, if you've got 1,000-2,000 square foot garden, you know, doing the drip tape, you know, if you have 1 4x10 foot bed, I can understand the temptation there. But one advantage of hand watering with a watering can is that you're out there and you're monitoring your plants more closely. So kind of think about, you know, like, you know, how big is your garden? I mean, if it's taking you 5-6 hours a week to water, then of course irrigation makes sense. If you're saving yourself 10-15 minutes, you know, you might want to consider just keeping that relationship up with your garden.
Let's talk with Ronald in Wyoming. Hi, Ronald.
Well, good morning. I guess it's the afternoon now.
Good afternoon.
I have a question about potting vegetables. I got vegetables in 24-inch by 24-inch high pots, various vegetables. What I'm after is the frequency of watering in a relatively dry period.
Yeah, you've really got to let your vegetables and the soil tell you when they need it. I would stick your finger in that pot. If it's moist there, you're probably okay. I think you just have to be on top of it and really monitor that. And, you know, I always, it's still the same old thing. Water heavily, but try to do it infrequently.
I mean, the rule of thumb is that, you know, plants need, you know, 1 inch of water a week. you know, so keep that in mind. But like Dave said, you know, stick your finger down to at least the second knuckle, and if there's some moisture in there, and it doesn't have to be soggy, you know, there's soggy soil and there's moist soil, and it's really, you know, after a day after you water, you want the soil to be moist.
Thank you, Ronald. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Anna emailed, I think, Peter, you were talking about watercress earlier, I think.
Oh, yeah.
She suggests it as an aquatic plant to grow. So
yeah, oh, yeah.
That might be
right.
The solution.
Yeah. Here, a cranberry bog.
Yeah. Let's talk with Jane in Oxford. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a question about hopefully controlling some grass in a perennial bed. I have the misfortune of living directly to the east of a pasture, which they let go to seed every year. And despite mulching and pulling, the grass just keeps coming back. And I hesitate to put a pre-emergent because I kind of depend upon the reseeding every year. So I was wondering if you might have some suggestions on that.
Okay.
Boy, you know, pulling the weeds, you know, some of these wonderful, really sharp hoes are great now. You can do a tremendous amount of work with those in a short period of time, severing the grass off. Some of those, of course, when you sever it, they're going to come back from the roots. There are post-emergent products that you could use herbicide-wise, but if you don't want to use pre-emergence, you probably don't want to use post-emergence either. So, mulching, Peter,
I mean, it's a rough call. I mean, there are some people use corn gluten as a pre-emergent, and I think Preen, oops, I'm supposed to say brand names, but there's some companies have some organic versions. Solutions. But I think that, you know, it's like a pretty rough situation. I mean, one thing is you get in there early and try and get the grass before it's, you know, sets its rhizomes and kind of gets really established. You can do that. I don't know whether it's possible to, you know, use something like shade cloth or something as a kind of a windbreak or as a cover over winter. Or late fall to try and keep some of the seed from drifting in. But like Dave said too, is that early spring, you know, using a sharp shuttle hoe or a will really be beneficial in terms of just chopping them off when they're young and letting them die.
513-419-7100 if you have any questions about gardening or landscaping, and let's talk with Yolanda and Colerain. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mark, I really enjoy your show. I listen to you at least 3 days a week.
Oh, thank you very much. Oh, I appreciate it very much.
No problem. My question is regarding my Oriental poppies, the perennial. They're done for the season. I was wondering, is it okay if I transplant them to another part in my garden flower bed? And then also I wanted to know, how do you keep your cilantro from continuing to flower? I trim it, and then a few days later, little flowers want to come up on it again.
Well,
thanks a lot.
Thank you, Yolanda.
I will take the easier question first, which is your cilantro. That is a very quickly maturing crop, and what you need to do is when you buy cilantro seed, or you buy it, you know, you really need to buy cilantro seed instead of the plant. I mean, it's okay to buy the plant, but it wants to complete its growth cycle in less than a growing season. For it, if you get a month out of a cilantro plant, you've probably done well, and you need to keep seeding it in your herb garden every 2 to 3 weeks, and then you will have young plants. And cilantro is just one of those herbs now that we just can't live without because of all the salsas and things that we're going to be making. So buy some cilantro seed and start seeding it pretty regularly.
Also, if you have an area of your garden that's shadier, plant it in shade. You can also use row cover or shade cloth with low hoops over it to extend its season. But like Dave said, it's succession planting, and it does better in cool weather. So a lot of people I know really sort of lay off of it midsummer, and so they do spring, and then they do a fall crop of it. But also, if you let it go to seed, you can replant that seed, and it's also the seeds itself obviously have a culinary use. So, but I agree with Dave completely. I would never buy a cilantro plant. Just direct sow it.
Yeah, the other part of her question.
Okay, that's
a tough one.
You know, if you do a really good job in you know, whenever people tell me they want to move something in midsummer, I always say, well, you want to do this so that plant doesn't know it's been moved. So what I'm telling you is make sure you take a really big, wide root ball around that plant. Have your hole where you're going to put it already dug. Pick that plant up. Get as much of the soil with it as you possibly can. Put it in that new planting area and water it carefully and just baby it. It probably would be better if you waited until fall, but if it needs to be done now, you know, some people move or whatever, it can be. But just remember that you are doing it at a tough time of the year and try to get as much root as you can.
We will continue our conversation, and you can get your questions answered about trees, plants, flowers, and veggies by giving us a call at 419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and our horticulture experts, Peter Huttinger and David Kester, join us this afternoon to answer your gardening questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Amanda in Sharonville. Hi, Amanda.
Good afternoon. Love your program.
Thank you.
My question is about my vegetable garden. This is my first season really going all out with the vegetable garden, and my neighbors were new to the neighborhood. My neighbors have warned me about birds eating tomatoes and squash, and I'm wondering what are some good deterrents for birds?
I haven't seen that much problem. Sometimes when we have an extremely dry year, I have seen birds that will come in, blackbirds will come in, and they'll peck a tomato. I've never seen a bird eat a squash. We have so many other wildlife problems. Birds are just, you know, the death of red raspberries and some of the small fruits and grapes. But in a vegetable garden, I don't think they're as tough. And again, you know, maybe netting your tomato plants if it's an issue. But I would wait until you really saw that you were losing fruit to them.
Yeah, I've had not much problems with it. I've had people that talk about young lettuce when it comes up. They'll come in and get into that, but with tomatoes and stuff. But, you know, often when squirrels come in and take a bite out of your tomato, what they're after is water. So one thing that I always recommend and I think is good to have in a garden, and it's also good for pollinating insects, is to have a bird bath.
Oh, leave a bowl of water out for the squirrels.
Yeah, so they can get so they have access to water, so that can help a little bit. The other problem we've had with corn with planting corn, we've had birds come in and peck out the seed. Yeah. You know, but I mean, there's many times when I'm turning the soil, or working in the garden, as I'm moving down the road, there's robins behind me, you know, looking for grubs and stuff. So, birds are the least of my problems.
Mike emailed. He has a hydrangea that will not bloom. It gets huge each year, but there are no blooms. It's planted under a white pine, so he's wondering if that could be the problem.
It shouldn't be. As long as it's getting a fair amount of sunshine, hydrangeas are a little bit more, you know, they don't have to have full blasted sun for 12 hours a day, but they do like sun, most of them do. I don't know. I've had this. The age of the plant would certainly be, but usually these hydrangeas now, they bloom when they're very young. Other things is, you know, I guess it's possible that it's too fertile there, too much fertility, but I don't see that is really the answer to it. You might want to take a cutting of that to your nursery and ask them, find out what kind of a hydrangea is and learn a little bit about its specific requirements.
Let's talk with Robert in Roselawn. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I got a question. I planted some flowers. My wife had kept picking on me about putting some flowers in the front yard. So I put some flowers out, and I got this purple foxglove flower. Mm-hmm. And when I planted them, the little flowers looked like little bells. They looked great. And then one of the plants started, the leaves started turning brown, and I thought it was probably because of the high heat in the sun, because it says it's supposed to be good in direct sunlight. So I took and put one of them giant umbrellas that you'd have like around a picnic table to kind of give them a little shade, you know, at certain times of the day. And I watered them at night, you know, maybe 10 minutes at night. And then I started watering them in the morning, maybe 10 minutes. And two of them look pretty healthy. One of them looks okay. And the other one looks like it's about ready to die. And I'm wondering if I'm overwatering it, maybe the sun just killed them because I just planted them late, or I don't know what's going on.
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't think your wife appreciates you enough because you're doing everything you can. But I'll be honest with you, I have always had problems with that particular plant. It just doesn't seem that this is its best environment here. And when you find that, it's the space in your, or the place in your yard, you can do that. I think I'll be honest with you, I'm not all that familiar with it, but I have had the same issues that you're having. And I think the heat can be an issue. And it sounds like you are watering a little too much. I think I would probably cut back on the water as well.
Yeah, they cut back with the water. And then also, if you have it mulched, use some mulch around it. But, you know, the black leaves sounds like it might be, possibly be fungal, which that could be the result of overwatering.
Mary Beth from Newport, she wants to plant some small trees and shrubs in containers and put them on her patio and keep them outside all year. So she's wondering if you had any suggestions for her.
Wow. You know, there's certainly the keeping them outside for the winter is the toughest part of that. And, Japanese maples, there's some wonderful little container trees, there's some peach trees that can be grown in containers very easily, as well as some evergreens if you want to go that route. But overwintering them is the most difficult part, because that container being above ground will freeze and thaw, and that root system is what you've got to protect. So if you're willing to niche it in, put it in a protected area, and do those things, but obviously these things are just going to get heavier and heavier as you repot and they grow, and so working with them is tough. But I think they'd be gorgeous out on a patio, and I would, if you can meet all those requirements and really check into how you're going to overwinter them to protect that root ball container, then you'd probably be very successful.
So going back to the repotted 50-year-old cactus that my wife and
yes.
I, it's not a good idea to leave that out on the patio either?
No, okay. It really isn't.
Well, another thing, too, is that you need to provide some, like you said, you heal them in somewhere, or you use some insulation around them. I've had some friends that had some compact conifers, you know, and what they had would do is that they'd had like old coffee bags that were larger than the containers, and then they would put straw around it, then mm-hmm. wrap the coffee bag around it, or you could use burlap and then tie it with twine so there was some insulation.
Even
there.
Like an empty raised bed, you could put the pots in that raised bed and then add soil to it after the pots. The soil is the greatest insulator that we have, just natural native soil. Putting that up around those pots, hopefully they're plastic or concrete so that they won't freeze and thaw and break. But that's really a good way to overwinter things outside.
And also I would go, when you go to buy the plant, as opposed to like going to like a big box store, go to a nursery and particularly find one that kind of specializes mm-hmm. or has a lot of experience and ask them tell them what you want to do and ask them what plants they recommend. Because there are some plants that are specifically bred for containers.
Right,
now.
There are some dwarf ones. Like you would not want a Norway spruce that matures at 80 foot in a container, but you can get a dwarf one or some of the other cultivars that would be really suitable.
Let's talk with Sarah in Newtown. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. We grow double delight roses, and they have really taken off in this weather. We typically treat with sulfur and 7, but the June bugs have been crushing us. What do you recommend to combat that?
That's such a neat flower, the double delight, and it's a really pretty one of our tougher hybrid teas. You probably know it's got a ton of thorns on it, but it's a really durable hybrid tree, and that it's a red and white bloom, and it's just spectacular.
That does sound pretty.
Yeah, and but anyway, June bugs. Roses. Those bugs are going to be a problem for you for not a real long period of time. So I would probably stick with some of the safer products. Maybe I don't think soap is going to do you much good, but maybe neem would be effective. And again, I think you can wait these things out. I always, on my roses, I always get so depressed during this time of year because I'm just inundated with Japanese beetles. But I always know that come later in the fall or in the summer, they're going to be gone and my roses are going to still be there and be spectacular. So you may, this is going to be a temporary problem for you.
Kind of to go along with Sarah's call, Dania emailed and wanted to know how to keep slugs off of roses that's not toxic. And she says, no luck with beer traps.
Oh.
That's what we would
that's where you would have headed, eh?
you might try the diatomaceous earth. I've had real success with that. And what that is a finely ground kind of a sea shell type of a micro, very small aquatic animals, and they grind, and it cuts the skin or the exoskeleton of the slug, and they wilt and die.
Yeah, another way you can trap them too is you just put a small board, say maybe 12 inches by 10 or 12, 16 inches or something, and lay it flat on the soil, and then go out in the morning and lift it up, and there'll be a lot of times those slugs will congregate underneath there, and then you can put them into either squish them or put them into soapy water and let them drown.
I prefer squishing. I put the board back down
satisfying?
And jump up and down on top of it.
Put the board on the sidewalk.
Absolutely.
And then,
what David does for fun.
It's a nice crunching sound, maybe.
Leo from Mount Healthy called. He was wondering, bamboo. He's got bamboo growing, and he is curious about how you get it to grow more bushy.
Whoa, that's usually not the question we get with bamboo.
How do you stop it?
If you've got a big area for it, bamboo really is, it is invasive and it will move. It can be kept in control by just mowing around it, but to get it to be, now we have had a couple of really tough years on bamboo, winters, and mine at the gardens and mine at home has really thinned out a good bit, but it is coming back. So that may be winter damage that you're seeing rather than, but I promise you it'll return.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation, and let's talk with Jim in Covington. Hi, Jim.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my
call.
Good,
thanks.
About 6 or 7 years ago, my wife and I bought a Japanese maple to put in our flower garden, and I will tell you, it does get full sun. And every year, without fail, it looks great in the spring. It just looks spectacular. And as you know, people who may not know, a Japanese maple is about shrub size. It never becomes a full-size tree. Between mid and late June, it starts to get brown. And the edges of the leaves get brown.
Yeah.
And further into the summer, it gets browner and browner. Is that just because I have it in full sun? Because I've tried watering it excessively. That didn't help. I even tried putting a gator bag on it for a couple of years and giving it water that way slowly, and that never did help. And so I don't know. There's no evidence of pests or anything on the leaves.
Yeah. And Jim, thanks for the question, by the way, because I have the same problem with my Japanese maple. The leaves start around this time. They start to get brown on the edges. And
Is it? I'm assuming this is one of the red cut leaf.
Yeah.
And they,
at least mine is.
And they are a little bit, but they would prefer a little bit more shade. Afternoon shade would be better for them, a better spot for them. But that sounds exactly like leaf scorch, which would be a lack of, being able to get enough moisture into the ends of those leaves. And so they're scorching. It's just a natural defense of the plant. I would really try mulching it and watering as you're doing. The gator bags, they're great, but boy, it's not a real good addition to your landscape. And so I would just maybe try watering once a week and then mulching good.
One thing when thinking about mulching trees too is remember you don't want to girdle the tree, like where the trunk goes down and you get your little bit of root flare. You don't want to cover that. So if you kind of think about maybe like a donut shape of mulch, going out to the drip line of the tree, so you don't want to pile it up. I've even seen in parks and stuff where they've got, you know, wood chips or mulch, you know, 6-8 inches up the trunk of the tree.
Yeah, that's horrible. And that needs to be backed away from the trunk. And then also, if you planted it, I'm not, you know, but sometimes they don't do the best job and make sure that you don't have girdling roots on the plant, or that they simply removed all the twine and the container from going into the thing, but so that there's no root restriction.
Jim, thanks for the call. JD emailed, how long from blossom to tomato? And some of his stems are turning yellow and they're falling off. So he was wondering if you knew of any causes for that.
Blossom to tomato, you're looking probably 50.
Well, 50 to 70 days,
yeah,
depending on the
70
variety.
Days.
Yeah.
And stems turning yellow, that is not good. Yeah. That sounds like maybe you're watering too much, or there are some wilt diseases and things like that. And I would, I would be taking some of those samples of that plant to a good nursery or to your extension office and trying to get a diagnosis for that.
Yeah, when you have that kind of material falling off your plant, you do want to remove it from around the plant. But also, I don't know how close your tomatoes are together. People have a tendency not to give them the space that they need. And because if that's fungal related, again, like we've talked about earlier, you know, that can be, it has to do with you're not getting enough airflow and direct sunlight.
Steve from Oxford called. He has a couple of acres of poison ivy. He wants to know how he can kill it without killing the grass. David, you got any advice on that?
Oh.
That's a toughie.
Well, it's... You know, poison ivy is a native, and it's really problematic. And if it's it has a lot of different growth forms, and it certainly can grow in a grass type situation. There are obviously there's herbicides that will kill broadleaves that will not kill your grass, and those can be used. Peter, you got any ideas on? 2 acres is a big area.
Yeah, I've never had to tackle anything like that. And I don't know if you did something like mowed it close, then, you know, dampen the area, then use plastic and try solarizing it for 6 months. But the things that are vining, that's usually not all that successful. I mean, not speaking as an employee of Turner Farm because it's certified organic, I mean, at our home where I have small clusters of them, if I can't rub it out, I will resort to using a broadleaf herbicide on it, as a topical spray on the leaf only, not the general area. And that's like after everything else doesn't work. But it's rough.
Last question, Beatrice, 7-year-old black-eyed Susans are getting black spots on the leaves. Help.
Huh. Oh, they're so tough. I don't know what exactly the black spot on the leaf is. I can't tell you exactly what disease that is. You can probably, I would imagine if they're 7 years old and you haven't divided them, it may be time to do that and give them some more room. And also there are, I've never had to apply any kind of a fungicide or anything else to a black-eyed Susan because they're just so durable. And you might want to try just even fertilizing them some. If they've been in 7 years and have never been fertilized, that would be a recommendation. And again, take a leaf into your favorite garden center or to your extension office and see if they can help you.
Well, Peter and David, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds and Lizzie Kibler. The technical director was Bruce Ellis. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.